This is Here and Now. I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. The state of Nebraska is passing two significant and stringent abortion laws today, laws that many say will attract strong legal challenge and will most likely wind up in the United States Supreme Court. The first law will require doctors to extensively screen women for possible mental and physical problems before performing abortions. The second will ban abortions past a certain stage of pregnancy based on the assertion that fetuses feel pain. Joining us on the line from the State House in Lincoln, Nebraska, is Fred Knapp, State House reporter for NET, a Nebraska public radio station in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hello, Fred. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. It's good to be with you.
Nebraska already has some of the toughest abortion laws in the country, and today your governor is signing two bills into law. Tell us first about the one that requires pre-screening.
That bill would require that physicians tell women about a whole host of risk factors that could be associated with abortion, anything from pre-existing emotional or physical conditions to demographic considerations. And it's rather open-ended in that these would have to be risk factors that had been identified in any one of a number of medical journals that are listed in medical indexes that the bill refers to.
So that provision is unusual because it spells out exactly what doctors must look for based on medical and scientific listings in journals, et cetera.
Yes.
And what if a doctor finds that a woman has a physical or a mental problem? Then what happens?
Well, he has to advise her and make an evaluation that whether or not, in spite of these identified risk factors, it's still less risky to go ahead with the abortion. And if he doesn't perform these tasks or doesn't perform them according to the letter of the law, the woman has a civil lawsuit possibility against him or her.
So how might this bill affect doctors who perform abortions?
Opponents of the bill would say that Nebraska, as you said, already has some of the strictest informed consent requirements in the country, and it might well be that this is just another checklist that doctors have to go through. On the other hand, adding these additional requirements increases, arguably, the possibility that they would miss something on the checklist and be open to a lawsuit.
And supporters would say?
Supporters would say, for all other medical procedures, we have extensive informed consent laws. You have to be given a dozen pages of information before you have an eye operation or a back operation, and this is just bringing abortion providers into the same category and requiring them to keep up to date on the medical literature.
The second bill deals with the idea that after a certain amount of time in the womb, a fetus feels pain. What is Nebraska's current law on how late an abortion can be performed, and what does the new law say?
Nebraska's current law follows the U.S. Supreme Court in saying that an abortion cannot be performed after viability, that is to say, when a fetus can survive outside the womb. And that's at the current state of medicine, around 23 or 24 weeks of pregnancy. This bill would change that to about 22 weeks, or as the bill puts it, 20 weeks after fertilization. It does that based on the idea that the fetus can feel pain, according to some medical experts at that time. On the other hand, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists issued a statement in 2005 that they haven't changed yet that says there's no evidence that a fetus can feel pain at that point.
So the governor of Nebraska signs these bills into law today at 2 o'clock. What's the timetable for appeals for these bills potentially going to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, that's interesting because everybody expects there will be lawsuits. And one of the only amendments that the pro-life and pro-choice sides agreed on was to delay the effective date of the flood bill, the fetal pain bill, for 6 months to prepare for the lawsuits.
Well, we'll be watching as this continues. Fred Knapp is a State House reporter for Nebraska Public Radio, speaking to us from Lincoln, Nebraska. Fred, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jane.
combat is horrific, but the battles can continue when soldiers cross back into civilian life. In fact, the moral and psychological questions posed by war often haunt veterans long after they leave the battlefield. Nancy Sherman is devoting her career to exploring these questions. Her new book is based on conversations with dozens of soldiers, veterans of World War II and Vietnam, and also some who served in Afghanistan and Iraq, including a former interrogator at Abu Ghraib, the infamous prison in Iraq. The book is The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. Nancy Sherman is a professor at Georgetown. She's also taught at the United States Naval Academy. She joins me now from the Christian Science Monitor Studios in Washington. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Jane.
What drew you to this work?
I think there were two reasons. Well, one is that I had been at the Naval Academy soaking in the environment and thinking a lot about soldiers and wrote a previous book, Stoic Warriors. I say soldiers to include all those in service. But there was another kind of unconscious reason, I think. My dad died in December, just as I was putting the final touches on this work. And as I was cleaning up his hospital effects, I found in his pockets his dog tags. He had carried them for 65 years. I never asked, and he never told me. He viewed war as a soldier's personal burden. His responsibility was enormous, but he didn't think he had to share it. And I guess as his daughter, somewhere deep down in the recesses of my soul, I thought, the public needs to understand much better than we do.
So as the title of your book, The Untold War, your dad's personal war was perhaps untold.
That's right, although this book is very much about the current burdens that soldiers and sailors, Marines, Air Force men and women go through. But, you know, I think lurking in the back was they need to tell their stories. And if we who don't wear the uniform are interested, a lot of moral clarity can be revealed, both for the soldier and for the public. So it's a shared national public obligation to understand what soldiers go through. We send them to war. They're our surrogates in many ways.
You write so movingly about crossing the border of peace and war, the border between civilian and soldier, soldier and civilian. Most of the soldiers that you spoke with have had real trouble with that transition.
The term was used early on in the wars that there would be seamless transition and that the kinds of services that were available would make for a seamless transition. Well, even if there were, in some ideal case, which typically doesn't exist, incredible health care for the soldiers and incredible non-stigmatizing psychological outreach, both for soldiers and for their families, there still would be, I argue in this book, from listening to soldiers, the ubiquitous burdens of war that they can't shake. And so I heard about a lot of forms of guilt. I heard about it in a way that was hard for warriors to articulate. It was often the elephant in the room, but they would talk about, in one very moving case, an Army officer early in the war in Iraq spoke about waking up every morning and feeling this terrible burden that he had on his watch. A Bradley fighting vehicle had a gun that went off and blew off the face of one of his privates, Private Joseph Myek. This particular officer, John Pryor, was exonerated. But in fact, this soldier, Pryor, lives every day with the guilt of on his watch while trying to protect his men and women, killing a soldier. That's enormous guilt. You know, there isn't acute PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. We're not talking about some of the classic physiological symptoms that the public knows about, hypervigilance or flashbacks. What I try to reveal are the everyday, ordinary emotions that soldiers struggle with as having been in war and coming home. The border passing is not easy.
You talk about the guilt. You also speak with soldiers who are dogged by shame. And one is Rob Kislow. He's a sniper who served in Afghanistan, who killed the guy who was trying to kill him, but now he feels like he doesn't deserve to wear the uniform of the United States military.
It was very complicated. His shame, in part, had to do with shaming. He had been in Walter Reed Hospital in the early days when the conditions were none too good, both physically shabby and somewhat stigmatizing for those with injuries, whether they were visible or invisible. And in most cases, folks returning home had both. In his case, there was some bullying that went on in the sense of, you know, if he couldn't make it to formation in the early in the morning, he was bawled out for that. And also, he just felt this terrible shame for not being able to continue to wear the uniform. He came home injured. He got the guy that was trying to get him and that got his friend. And his shame was both that he had to take off the uniform because he couldn't continue to fight. He lost a leg and also has a titanium arm. I mean, he really fought hard in a horrible, horrible swarming of insurgents against him. He was very much outnumbered. But he also felt this shame that he needed to fight with revenge, a kind of payback. There was only, you know, one way to get this guy that was going to get him, and that was to feel ramped up and revved up. And he said, it's the best feeling I've ever had. But he then had this sense, a quieter sense. He says, you think we enjoy it? It's just a job. It's just a job. And so there's this sense of having to reflect on what it takes to be able to do the business of war.
Nancy, you also spoke with soldiers who are struggling because they feel suckered, in your words. Bob Steck, a Vietnam vet, Derek Vines, who also served, he served in Iraq. They feel, they say, they served in wars that were unjust. How does a soldier make sense of that question?
Well, that's a really hard struggle. There's lots of academic debate about whether soldiers really are fighting justly when they're fighting a cause that's not just, even if their conduct is most honorable. And as Bob Steck, a Vietnam veteran, put it to me, we have to believe that if we in our personal lives fought in the most honorable ways. In fact, he went to Vietnam rather than others because he thought he could uphold high standards, that we have to be able to separate the cause from the soldier. And I think many of us are accepting that in the public when we support our troops, even if we don't support a war. But that still doesn't quiet the moral quandary and intense internal debate for the soldier. In the case of Bob Steck, he said, I don't feel shame. I feel a sense of being tainted. And tainted is a kind of sense of being polluted, as if every pore has a bit of a toxin in it, you know. And there was Michael Herr reported on Vietnam in a book that he later wrote called Dispatches, and he said, I went to Vietnam to cover the war, but the war covered me. So there's that sense. And then I had a different word, a very morally freighted word that appeared in the conversations with Derek Vines. He felt betrayed. He said, you know, he's part of an intel unit, I went to Iraq to look for WMDs, weapons of mass destruction. Did we ever find any? Did the commissions ever say there were any there? No. And he said, to be suckered like that by your upper echelon, that's a hard pill to swallow. I don't care if you're, you know, the president's a Democrat or Republican. The top brass to sucker us leaves the foot soldier really with a sense of betrayal, I think.
Nancy Sherman's book is The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. When we come back, how two interrogators face moral questions very differently. And later in the program, we revisit a conversation we had with a photojournalist and the young soldier he followed for 2 years. Yesterday, that photographer, Craig Walker, won the Pulitzer Prize. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Robin Young, back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Nancy Sherman, author of The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. It's based on conversations with dozens of veterans struggling with moral and psychological questions. Nancy, the parts of the book that deal with the issue of torture are fascinating for many reasons. Can you paint the contrast for us between two interrogators with whom you spoke, Will Quinn, who questioned detainees at Abu Ghraib, and another interrogator named Captain Ray Longworth?
Will Quinn is a student at Georgetown whom I've come to know fairly well over the past 4 years, and he was part of the cleanup act, a poster boy for the new Abu Ghraib, and he's a very, very upright individual. And I asked him, were there things that you felt you did wrong or you might have crossed a line? And I really was expecting some difficult things to hear. And instead, he surprised me with his answer. In one case, he said that a Sunni and a Shiite male detainees wanted recreation time, but he put them out together. And so it was as good as if they didn't have any time out of solitary. In another case, a woman detainee showed signs of falling in love with him and he sort of let it continue. And there were other cases as well of showing a detainee pictures of family members that had been blown up by a rival tribal group and finally getting someone to talk and then walking out 8 hours later of the detention cell and laughing a bit thinking, I got him to talk. So it was the idea of building intimacy in order to exploit it. That just felt awful to Will when he put on his non-interrogator sensibilities, his full human sensibilities. And what was remarkable about Will is he never really lost them. He knew well the temptations of power. He knew well when you couldn't get someone to talk what you would be tempted to do, but he never stepped over the line. And I so admire him for that. And he really was and remains an important figure in how to do interrogation right. But it's not without moral cost. Longworth, a pseudonym, is an interrogator much older, in some ways more jaded, and who felt no moral qualms about, as he put it, letting others do the United States work. He would essentially let others do the softening people up and, in some cases, torturing them and, you know, using them like paper, like toilet paper, he said, and then throwing them out. He never would think about what he did in any moral tones, nor did he really feel any moral constraints on what he was willing to watch, see, and condone. So very different kind of sensibilities.
I think the saddest story in your book is the story of Army Colonel Ted Westhusing. He committed suicide. Would you tell us what happened?
Ted Westhusing was a colleague, taught ancient ethics, as I do. Loved Aristotle, Plato, and the Greek notion of virtue and the Homeric notion of honor, and went to West Point as a permanent military professor, and really hadn't seen the current two wars, and so really wanted to go to Iraq, and was there, and he was in charge of contractors who often are under somewhat different rules of command, and the chain of command is rules of engagement, pardon me, and the chain of command can be murky. And so he witnessed cases where they had done things they ought not to do regarding use of firearms. And he also was in charge of training Iraqi police. And again, their rules are somewhat different than his and the American rules, but yet he was supporting them and training them. And so there were lots and lots of areas of moral compromise that did not sit easy with him. He wrote a suicide note saying that he had felt sullied by the war and by what was required. And that was just after briefing General Petraeus, who had praised him for his work. And this is a star, you know, getting one of these professorships at West Point is really competitive. And it was heartbreaking because this is a case where one's own morals and the murky, murky moral gray of war, that moral fog, just could not be sorted through by this individual. I know others, one other who was in the exact same role and comparable position in the Army, for whom these were nasty, nasty, nasty moral compromises and having to sometimes do business the way others do that's very unsavory. But a healthy sense of cynicism is what can get you through. But moral rigidity often doesn't work. So that the lesson I came away with as someone who teaches midshipmen and lectures at military universities around the world, that you have to look in advance at not just right and wrong, but all the shades of gray that are in between. The ideal moral world is not the battlefield. The battlefield is messy. You try not to lose your integrity, but you may have to bend a little bit here and there in a way that you can stomach and tolerate.
Are you concerned, Nancy, that there will always be some sort of disconnect between the civilian and the soldier? There'll be thousands of veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And frankly, unless you're related to one of those soldiers, most of us have no idea what they're going through in the battlefield, and especially when they come home.
I'm terribly concerned about this. Even when veterans return to a place like a university, which is a small community with small classrooms, the subject doesn't always come up of what'd you go through as a soldier in the current wars, what were some of the hard challenges, what is it like now. It's often thought of as trespassing, a kind of moral trespass, or from the warrior's side, they won't understand and they're not really interested. So I really am urging bringing down the walls and opening up the conversation, and it requires a two-way street. It requires much more empathetic listening and curiosity and a sense of moral obligation on the part of civilians who don't put on the uniform, and also a willingness on the part of those who do wear the uniform to open up a bit and to trust that their neighbors or their colleagues are interested and can understand in some way. And I'm afraid you can't understand until you really sort through some of the issues. So the book is, The Untold War, is really meant as a chance to help conceptualize some of these hard, hard problems through the voices of soldiers themselves who are working it out.
Well, Nancy Sherman, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Nancy Sherman's book is The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. Thailand's defiant anti-government protesters are not backing down. They're threatening to launch another street offensive and say they will not end their demonstrations until the government resigns. The so-called red shirt protesters withstood deadly street battles over the weekend. The BBC's Rachel Harvey joins us now from Bangkok. Rachel, what's happening there today?
Well, I've been out on the streets earlier today, and those red-shirted protesters are still very defiant. But today is the Buddhist New Year, so it's been a bit of a lull in terms of confrontation. Protest leaders are planning another big rally tomorrow. They're not letting the pressure off at all. They now say they are absolutely determined to try and force this government from power. They want to see a dissolution of parliament and early elections, and they are piling the pressure on the Prime Minister, Apisit Wechichiwa.
Who are these red shirt protesters? We see pictures of thousands of people wearing red shirts. Who are they, and what do they want?
It's a very good question as to who they are. There are people who describe them as simply supporters of the now exiled Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who was forced from power in a military coup in 2006. I think that the movement has now become much broader than that. There are others within the movement now who are former communists, who are left-wing activists, who are pro-democracy activists. It's become a kind of loose coalition of people that want to see reform in Thailand, that want to see their country take a different direction. This really is now a battle for the soul of Thailand and the direction in which people want it to go. Most of these people who are out on the streets are from poorer, more rural areas, but by no means all. There are also a lot of working-class people who have been coming out and joining the protests for, say, a few hours and then going back to their day jobs.
So bottom line here, this is a deeply divided population, Rachel, all looking for some sort of reform.
That's absolutely right. There is a group within power at the moment who the protesters view as being elitist, the military, the elite bureaucracy, and to some extent some of the advisors to the palace and the palace. There is another group that say, look, it's time for Thailand to move forward to become a more modern democracy, and that is really the battle at the heart of all this. Everybody says they are loyal to the king. This is really about what sort of parliamentary representation they should be, and that ordinary people want their votes to count. This is a country that has seen 18 military coups since 1932.
Rachel, this morning I read reports that the government offered to dissolve parliament within 6 months and that protesters rejected that offer. Is that a new offer, and is it valid?
It would have been a new offer. We understand that that offer was made by some of the coalition partners that are inside the rather fractious coalition government, who went to the protesters and said, look, what about 6 months? The Prime Minister had a couple of weeks ago offered 9 months. The protesters rejected that. Now they've been offered 6 months and they say no. The sad thing is that had that offer been made 2 weeks ago, maybe it would have been accepted. Who knows? But now, after the bloodshed on Saturday, the protesters are so angry, and so are the military. The military were forced to beat a humiliating retreat. 21 people lost their lives. More than 800 were injured. People are still trying to come to terms with that. The idea of the two sides now sitting down across a table and trying to work out a timetable for elections seems, at the moment, rather far-fetched. But ultimately, that is probably where things will end up, with the early elections that the demonstrators have been demanding.
Rachel, what are the broader implications of this uprising in the region?
Well, this is obviously a bastion of support for the United States. The United States has long been a loyal supporter of Thailand. Throughout the Indochina Wars, Thailand was used as a base for U.S. troops. And within this region, Thailand has been a very strong economy and a very strong trading partner, whereas all the other economies in Asia are looking at maybe 6-7% growth this year. Thailand is trailing long behind, and that is because of the political situation. It's holding the region back, and people are looking on very, very nervously.
But do you expect more violence?
In the short term, Probably not. No one wants to see that sort of confrontation, but it's a question really of whether the more militant voices on both sides want to provoke the situation again and try and force some kind of resolution to this rather than a negotiated settlement.
The BBC's Rachel Harvey speaking to me from Bangkok, Thailand. Rachel, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Tucked deep in the health care reform law is a new insurance program to provide for long-term care. It's called the CLASS Act, that stands for the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports Act. It was originally proposed by the late Senator Edward Kennedy. It's a government-run insurance program you buy into, and it would pay you cash when you need it for help at home with cooking, bathing, getting to the doctor's office, or to pay for home nursing care. Currently, about 50 million family members in this country and friends are helping care for 10 million Americans with some level of disability. This law is meant to bring them some relief. But how much will it cost, and how exactly will it work? Veteran journalist Howard Gleckman joins me now from the Christian Science Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. His book is called Caring for Our Parents. Nice to have you, Howard. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you, Jane.
This program is in the new health care law, but this is insurance for long-term care. So explain the difference. What exactly is long-term care?
Sure. Long-term care is the personal assistance that people with chronic illness or frail old age need to care for themselves over the course of their lives, to live as normal a life as they possibly can. It's very different from acute medical care, which, of course, is what most of the rest of the health bill is about.
And to be clear, this long-term care is not just for the elderly, right?
That's correct. About 60% of people who require long-term care are older than 65, but about 40% are younger. They may suffer from chronic disease like MS. They may have had automobile accidents or sports accidents or that sort of thing. Many of those younger people with disabilities, of course, can work, but they still need help getting started in the morning or bathing or eating or that sort of thing, and that's what long-term care is.
So what exactly is in the provision?
Well, what this does is it provides a national voluntary long-term care insurance program. I think most of your listeners are familiar with private long-term care. This would be a government long-term care policy. It would work in some ways a little bit like Medicare does, although it's different in a couple of key aspects. Basically, what happened is starting in 2012, the government would begin to offer insurance policies. You would be automatically enrolled in those insurance policies if your employer agreed to participate. If you wanted to opt out, you could, but like a lot of 401k plans, initially you would be automatically enrolled in the policies. Hmm. Premiums would be based on your age, but they could not adjust premiums for pre-existing conditions. They couldn't reject you because you had a pre-existing condition. So everybody, as long as they were working, would be covered by this if they chose to.
You mentioned that the premiums are set by age, but that really the two big unanswered questions are the amounts of the premiums and the benefits. Those have not been set yet. Do we know at least a range for those?
That's exactly right. The law keeps this very general, and it's going to be up to the administration to decide exactly what this looks like. But in general, we know the benefit is going to be around $50 or $60 a day. What's very important about that benefit is it will be in cash, and that means you'll have the flexibility to do whatever you wanted with it. You could use it to pay a family member to watch out for you or to help bathe you. You could use it to hire a paid aide, a professional aide. You could use it to build a wheelchair ramp. There's actually a provision in the bill that allows you to collect money in advance. So if you had a $2,000 or $3,000 cost for a wheelchair ramp or a grab bars in your bathroom, you could do that with the benefit. And you would get the benefit for life. You get it for as long as you needed it. As I say, it would be somewhere around $50 or $60 per day, but we don't know for sure. The premium is a very interesting question. The sponsors of the bill originally hoped they could do this for about $65 a month on average. Again, younger people would pay a lower premium. Older mm-hmm. people would pay a higher one. Mm-hmm. But they hope they could do this for about $65. There's some new research that's just out by the SCAN Foundation and the Avalere Health consulting firm, which suggests that the average cost would probably be around $115 a month for a class-like policy. They modeled the policy. It was slightly different than class, but more or less the same kind of a design. So somewhere maybe in the neighborhood of $100 or $115 a month.
So who determines and how do you determine exactly who is disabled enough to qualify for this benefit, Howard?
your disability would be decided by your physician or other health professional. That's a little different than the way private insurance works. Usually with private insurance, there is an employee or a contractor of the insurance company that would decide. In this case, your physician would decide. And there's some people who object to that. They say that anybody's doctor is going to say that you're disabled so that you can get that benefit. One of the interesting challenges here is they need to find a way to balance the generosity of the benefit with the cost of the premium. In the insurance business, there's something they call adverse selection. And without getting too technical, what that means is that what often happens is the people who most need insurance buy it. And when people who really need insurance buy it, that drives up the cost for everybody else and discourages people who think they may not need it from buying. And that creates what they call the death spiral. The premiums go up and up, mm-hmm. And fewer healthy people participate. Mm-hmm. So they have to be careful to not do that. One of the decisions they made early on in this debate was to make this a voluntary program. In most of the rest of the world, the long-term care insurance is a mandatory program.
Right, and you've been stressing all along that this insurance needs to be mandatory.
I think it does. I think ultimately it's going to be a mandatory program. That's what we've just decided to do with health care, and I think ultimately we're going to have to do it with long-term care.
And the bottom line, if it's not mandatory, it will drive up costs. Is that the bottom line?
It'll drive up costs. This same research that I was just mentioning from the SCAN Foundation suggests that while an average premium for a voluntary program is about $115 a month, if it were mandatory, it'd only be about $30 or $40 a month. And $40 a month, of course, is very manageable for almost any American. All of these, by the way, do include a low-income subsidy so that people who are very poor would be able to buy the insurance very inexpensively. The CLASS Act, for example, allows that people who are very poor or people who are students could buy insurance for as little as $5 a month.
Howard, why is this so important in our last minute here? There are many people listening who might say, well, $50 a day, that's not much.
Well, I'll tell you, $50 a day isn't much if you're in a nursing home where the average cost is over $200 a day. But most of us get our care, 80% of us get our care at home. And for people at home, $50 a day can buy 4 or 5 hours of help from an outside aide. It can provide a tremendous amount of assistance for a family member, a spouse or an adult child who's trying to care for a parent and keep a job and care for their kids. So $50 a day is a big deal for people who are trying to provide the sort of assistance for loved ones.
Veteran journalist Howard Gleckman is with us. His book is Caring for Our Parents. Howard, thank you for this important information. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Back in just a minute. You're listening to Here and Now. Journalists at the Denver Post erupted into cheers yesterday when they learned that their colleague, photographer Craig Walker, won the Pulitzer Prize for feature photography. For more than 2 years, Walker photographed a young man named Ian Fisher as he went from high school student to Army recruit to basic training to soldier. Yesterday, editors at the Denver Post, who had been tipped off that Walker was going to win the Pulitzer, snuck Fisher and his parents into the newsroom to be there for the celebration. Walker immediately thanked Fisher and his parents for letting him get so close to the family.
The people that deserve the real thanks are standing right here.
Yeah.
For Ian and family, you know, for sharing their story, for not only being honest, but being brutally honest, as Terry always said, works and all.
Ian Fisher's story was brutally honest. After basic training, Fisher was stationed at Fort Carson near his Colorado home. He came home a lot. He partied a lot, too. A substance abuse problem almost got him kicked out of the Army. But he went into treatment, got a second chance, and he was shipped off to Iraq. Last year, Here and Now's Robin Young spoke with Ian Fisher and Craig Walker. She asked Craig to describe first what he thought the story was about.
With Ian being stationed at Fort Carson for a year in between basic training and deployment, being so close to home and so close to his friends, while it was a story about a high school graduate becoming a soldier, it's also a story about a young man growing up.
And Ian, was it hard reading some of that? I mean, not many of us get to read, you know, our passage from adolescence to adulthood and have a photojournalist there. Was it hard to read that late night party with a girlfriend or the first time you were driving the Humvee in Iraq and almost drove into a canal? Was it hard to read some of those rites of passage?
I believe at times, but the story was definitely an amazing blessing, because without the story, I don't think I would have been able to realize too much about myself rather than being interviewed every month.
It was sort of like being forced to be introspective.
Definitely, yeah. And I think that really helped my life.
Let's go back to, you know, we see you go to basic training, and there were these moments, you know, obviously where you were learning. You forget to knock on a superior's door. You just walk right in, and he sends you back out again. Mm-hmm. But then you're standing around with some combat vets, and they're talking about, I think it's avoiding explosives or something, and you say something about, wow, that might be cool. What did they say to you?
My old squad leader, he's my first squad leader when I got to the unit, and as punishment, he made me write a list of every soldier that has died in OIF and OEF, Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom.
Uh-huh. And in fact, he told you to write the list. What did you do at first?
I printed them off the internet.
Typical young person. But then he made you go back and handwrite.
Yes.
What did that experience do for you? You know, as you wrote these names, yours could have been one of them.
Well, to be honest with you, I was just so new to the military that I didn't think too deeply into what I was actually doing and seeing the names that I was actually seeing.
Does it mean something more to you now, having been in combat?
No, of course.
Well, Craig Walker, you're watching a lot of this and writing about it and taking pictures. You watch him through basic training. He sprains his ankle at one point, and so he's making a lot of trips home. He's taking painkillers. His dad is worried about it. Are you worried in this point of the story as well?
Yeah, I had, you know, there were probably two points in the story that I stressed out about where it was going to go. One of them was at basic training while Ian was going through processing. He had fallen one night and banged his elbow and gone for an x-ray, and I guess had a conflict with a drill sergeant for not asking permission to go and get the x-ray. But, you know, it seemed at the time he saw the injured elbow as an opportunity to get out of his contract with the Army. And I was looking at Ian and all the soldiers in the Army. It's a very high-stress situation, like when they get off that bus and there's sleep deprivation, culture shock. You know, I think I made my favorite picture at that point as well.
Which was that?
It's a picture of Ian sitting in the recruiter liaison's office. He's sitting in a chair, and he's in his fatigues, and his head is freshly shaved. You know, there's the classic Uncle Sam poster that says, "I want you for the U.S. Army." And Ian sort of got his elbow cradled on his lap. It just spoke volumes to me about second thoughts on joining the Army for anyone, you know, obviously not just for Ian, because while I was, you know, watching Ian go through all this, I was watching an entire platoon plus going through the same thing.
Right. Ian, you know, we're wondering, you said at one point you felt like you were made out of glass, you know, things were starting to shatter, your elbow, your ankle, and you got in a little too deep with painkillers, and at one point had to go into a drug abuse program for that. Did you think at a certain point, I'm not going to make it?
There have been a few times throughout my military career that I've thought that.
Yeah. How did you make it?
Usually when I was either in pain mentally or physically, I always had my father, who is my biggest lifeline, even now.
And your dad was the one who knew that you were about to get in trouble with drugs and help steer you towards some help. One of your colleagues, one of the older veterans, is quoted in the Denver Post saying, "Every once in a while, somebody trips up, and I firmly believe that if you can help that guy pick himself up, dust himself off, take a look in the mirror, and chalk it up as a learning experience, I'd say 8 times out of 10, that person's going to turn around and do well." Ian Fisher's one of those cases. Is that how you see yourself?
I think so. When I was switched over to to a different platoon before we left for Iraq, they definitely gave me a true second chance, and they were there for me, and I think that's what I needed.
That's Ian Fisher and photojournalist Craig Walker talking to Hira Now's Robin Young late last year about the Denver Post series Ian Fisher, An American Soldier. Yesterday, Walker won the Pulitzer Prize for feature photography.